When you apply to college, most schools will ask if you've ever been convicted of a crime. And for U of I master's student Chris Miner, that simple checkbox made him question whether he should apply in the first place.
And I just sit there and stared at the screen for like 10 minutes. It was like everything, every advancement I made so far might be over with. Maybe this is the end of the ride.
Plus, we've all told little white lies, but according to new research from the University of Chicago, the whole truth and nothing but that might be the best way to go. Here's behavioral scientist Emma Levine.
I think what was surprising is that, you know, honesty in the end actually didn't look that different from kindness.
But first, for the first time since 2012, the USDA is rolling back some Obama-era regulations on school lunches. Critics worry about the possible health effects, and supporters are encouraged to have more flexibility. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, why do we lie? We tend to think it's because it's for the better, but is it? We speak to a University of Chicago researcher about her new study. And how does committing a crime affect someone's chance at a college education? We'll speak with Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines and a few others about that. But first, about a month ago, for the first time since 2012, the USDA announced that they're rolling back some Obama-era regulations around school lunches. Since the announcement, critics like the American Heart Association have expressed concern we're reversing our progress on making school lunches and the kids that eat them healthier. Supporters of the change say now they have more flexibility and contend that these changes will lead to less food waste. Megan Gibbons is with us now. She's president of the Illinois School Nutrition Association. She's also the director of nutrition services for Valley View School District in Bolingbrook. That's just southwest, a suburb of Chicago. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla. Thanks so much for having me.
In studio with me is Lindsay Jones, an education reporter for the News Gazette in Champaign. She's been reporting on this issue and speaking to superintendents, school districts around Central Illinois. Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for being here as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Lindsay, before we get to these most recent changes, I wondered if we could take a step back and go back to 2012. You know, over the holidays, I was reading Becoming, Michelle Obama's biography, and it was so interesting to read her account how, as First Lady, she led the charge to the Healthy, Hunger-Free Kids Act. And I wonder, what kind of standard did that initiative set for nutrition and school lunches?
Sure. So we all kind of remember that Michelle Obama's, you know, one of her most noteworthy causes was raising that public consciousness around childhood health and nutrition, and especially when it is related to school meals. So there were a lot of different components of that campaign, and part of it culminated in the 2010 passage of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. And then those standards that were set in that kind of, you know, were rolled out around 2012. And that Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act really set the stage for, you know, promoting the usage of more fruits and vegetables in school lunches, promoting more whole grain rich foods, and aiming to cut fat and sodium content in these school breakfast and lunches. They put benchmarks in place for schools to meet across the country over a period of 10 years as far as like reducing the amount of sodium. And that act also expanded the number of children who could access that federal school breakfast and lunch program through various means, including using Medicaid data to automatically certify some children's participation. So just really opening up that pool of kids who can get that kind of like healthy food from school.
Megan, how did those changes in 2012 change the way you all do your job, and how did that change the component of school nutrition?
They made a huge impact on us, and really wonderful changes, always with good intent. The only challenge we had and our members had was the timeline of them, because the change did occur pretty quickly from when they were rolled out to when to an implementation occurred. But it changed our world quite drastically in the way we write menus, from whole grains to sodium to fruits and vegetables, specific color groups of those, minimum and maximums for calories, sat fat, many, many regulations that were rolled out at that time.
Megan, why do you think that this is an important issue? Why do you think school lunches matter? I mean, I think for people who don't have children, they might think, does this really matter? Does this make a difference in people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm biased because I do have children. And I always like to think of my 16,000 children at Valley View School District as my own kids, too, feeding the future. Of course, they're important. Whether you have children or not, they are our future. So from from health to future jobs and economic growth. We want the best for our kids. I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And feeding them a healthy, wholesome meal at school, whether they're bringing their own or they're having it at school, it makes a huge impact on their future.
And how much do you think what's served in a cafeteria sets a culture or standard for kids, Megan?
I think it sets a standard in the fact that kids, just like adults, we rely on what our peers are doing, and we're constantly watching and looking for social norms, if you will. And the cafeteria is their dining room at school. So they're watching peers of their own age, what they're eating, what they're not eating. And it certainly spreads awareness to students in their own peer group, but also they bring that back home. We hear many parents asking our kitchen managers, hey, where do you purchase XYZ item? Because their kid enjoyed it at school, and so they want to replicate that at home. So it really really goes from the cafeteria into the classroom and back home.
That said, Lindsay, I wonder how these changes that have now just taken effect, how that's changed the previous guidelines. So before, you were talking about whole grains, more whole grains, less salt, more vegetables. What do these new guidelines, now this rollback, what's changed now?
Sure. So we're kind of reverting away from a requirement that all grain products be 100% whole grain. We're rolling that back to whole grain rich, which is around 50% whole grain, 50 or 51%. Schools already carried fat-free milk, but this change brings back flavored 1% milk, so like your strawberry, your chocolate. Another thing it does, which is kind of interesting, is it halts sodium reduction efforts. So I believe it's the second benchmark in the 10-year program. That's actually been pushed back to the 24-2025 school year. So they'll have a lot more time to meet that
regulation.
Correct.
And Megan, are there other laws as well in Illinois that regulate what is served in school cafeterias, or does this mostly come down to federal regulation?
Almost exclusively federal. From the state agency standpoint, they provide training on those federal guidelines. They certainly can be more restrictive, but again, our programs are almost exclusively federally regulated in terms of meal components and meal patterns.
And Megan, as these changes, and these changes have a slower implementation, it sounds like, right, than the Obama era regulations. These give districts time to get used to this. It sounds like the implementation and the changes is happening at a slower pace than the previous changes, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I agree with that fully. What I would say is there is this this thought out there right now that everything that the First Lady, Michelle Obama, and Congress did at the time and USDA is being rolled back, and that's just not the truth. We just have some flexibility on those three key components that Lindsay touched on, which is sodium. It's important to say that we are at what's called Tier 1 sodium levels. So we are there now. We have made significant progress. There was no sodium restrictions prior to that 2010 passage of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. So we've made huge reductions in sodium. And that takes time for kids to adjust their palate dramatically. So we're there now, and we want to continue getting our customers, our students, adjusted to those sodium levels. So correct that the Tier 2 sodium will now be pushed back to 2024, I believe it is. And then the Tier 3 sodium, which was originally on the radar, has been eliminated from the future guidelines. Whole grains was, we are giving some flexibility with whole grains, whereas instead of 100% whole grains, we do now have 50% whole grains. That's huge. You know, I'm a dietitian and a mom. I always say when I open my pantry at home, I do not have 100% whole grains, and that's okay. That's practical. We don't have to have every single grain in our diet whole grain, but we certainly want to have a good variety in our diet, and that 50% criteria really helps us with that piece. And the last piece is the milk, and currently we offer exclusively non-fat milk, whether that's flavored or unflavored. It must be non-fat. That 1% low-fat milk option does give a good variety to our members to offer those options to their kids. And the ultimate goal is to increase customer participation, but also increase what kids are actually eating versus throwing away.
And I wonder if we could just come back to, you were talking about the tears with salt, Megan. So can you give us an example of what food maybe was cut out or is included now, or was the actual sodium, I'm thinking of, for example, something like chicken nuggets, was it just the actual sodium content in that that was lowered, or were actual food items thrown out because of the sodium content?
Yeah, that's a good question. So with sodium and with all of our nutritional requirements, it's actually over the course of 5 days. So over the course of a 5-day average, you must average that. Let's just talk with elementary lunch, because that's probably a more common one, right? An elementary lunch, tier one sodium, is at 1,230 milligrams or less. So a good example of that I like to give is your standard turkey sandwich type lunch, right? So let's say you had a turkey wrap with a whole grain wrap and maybe some lettuce in there, what have you, probably some condiments, maybe some mustard, a little mayo, what have you. That turkey wrap, even using a low sodium turkey, is going to have almost 800 milligrams of sodium. Then you have to, of course, offer your fruits and veggies, which do have naturally occurring sodium in vegetables. Fruits are typically sodium free, but typically you're going to pick up about maybe 200 milligrams of sodium there. And then milk has naturally occurring sodium, anywhere from 110 to 130 milligrams. So once you back out the milk component, which we must offer, the fruits and vegetables, of course, we're down to an entree. It really needs to stay between 500 to 700 milligrams in an entree, which is pretty challenging as a parent for me to do at home. And in this setting, luckily, we have really great industry to work with. The USDA, helps us really get some great foods that are lower sodium and good tasting, cooking with herbs and spices, all the things we've kind of heard of before. But we've certainly drastically reduce sodium limits. So the thought out there that we're rolling back and we're not is a misperception. But again, having some flexibility and staying at that tier one sodium target for a few more years.
That's Megan Gibbons. She's president of the Illinois School Nutrition Association. We've also been speaking with education reporter Lindsay Jones. She's with the News Gazette in Champaign. Lindsay, for your reporting on this, you talked to several different school administrators. What are you hearing from them about these changes? Is it similar to what Megan's telling us?
Sure. It depends on who is spoken with. So one of the key people that we interviewed was a food services director at an area district. And from her, yes, there was a very pronounced appreciation for what she called flexibility. She talked about how there were products, and this was brought up several times, was like for breading on chicken tenders that she would serve. That breading had to be whole grain. So there was a talk about how that could be difficult to find on occasion. So her being able to have that kind of breathability, she appreciated that. But one thing that struck me is that the number of districts in the area who don't do in-house food preparation, who don't employ like a food services director and make everything in-house, I think that number is higher than people might realize. And
so most people use a contractor then, is what you're saying.
Several. And they work with companies like Aramark. Aramark was the predominant one that I encountered. We did reach out to them for comment a couple of times.
And didn't hear from them.
No,
right.
Did not. But that's kind of an interesting thing to think about, is some districts, they believe that it's more fiscally feasible for them to contract that work out, to contract that food out. So Aramark is bringing that food in, and that's just an interesting element of kind of privatization that is already there.
And Megan, it sounds like for Bolingbrook, for your district, it sounds like you are running all of that, or do you all use Aramark as well?
No, we don't. So there are two different operations, which Lindsay alluded to. You have contract management, that's your Aramarks, your Sodexo, your Quest of the world, and there's a lot of them in the state of Illinois. I believe, I don't know the actual number, but I want to say it's around 50% of our school districts in Illinois that use a contract management service. Versus the other option you have is an independent operator, that's like myself and my department. So we work for the school district, same with the food service director that Lindsay had interviewed for. I read that article there, the St. Joe food service director, independent operator. So they're going to work for the school district. Both are going to meet the USDA meal patterns. There's probably pros and cons of both. But again, the independent one is working for the school district, all in-house operation.
We just have about a minute or two left. But Megan, I wanted to just ask you about food waste, because you mentioned that a couple of times. Do you think that these new changes will reduce the amount of food waste that happens in schools?
I absolutely think they will reduce the amount of food waste. We host precept dietetic interns here in my school district, as do a lot of our members. And I have my interns conduct a plate waste study every single time they have a new intern. That's one of their jobs. I don't think they appreciate the fact that I'm asking them to count trash, but the data that we get from it is really incredible. And the greatest waste that we see so often is milk, grains, of course, it's the whole grain component piece of it, and fruit. Ironically, it is whole fruit that's thrown out. If it's cut fruit, we see a 75% reduction in plate waste. So we stop serving as much whole fruit and mainly offer cut fruit. But I definitely think that our plate waste, our actual consumption, so the nutrition going in to the mouths of children will be increased with this flexibility. And hopefully we'll get some customers back too, because the other piece we've seen is that our paid customers, so the students that do not qualify for a free or reduced price meal, but our paid customer participation has continuously gone down ever since these regulations were in place.
So it'll be very interesting to see how all of this unfolds in the next year or so. Megan, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Megan Gibbons is the president of the Illinois School Nutrition Association. She's also director of nutrition services at Valley View School District in Bolingbrook in the southwest Chicago suburbs. I want to thank Lindsay Jones for being with us as well. Her reporting on this is partially why we had this conversation. We'll tweet out her story that she did for the News Gazette, where she's an education reporter. Megan, Lindsay, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's a new year, and we're launching some new things on the 21st, including a new feature where you can send us questions you'd like us to answer on air. It's called Ask the 21st, and we're starting with questions you might have about our newest government on Monday. Democrat J.B. Pritzker will be sworn in as our next governor. Democrats will have big majorities in both the State House and the Senate. So what questions do you have, not just about our next governor, or maybe about lawmakers, where they stand on issues like taxes and marijuana? We're going to answer your questions next Monday during a special live broadcast of the 21st from the inauguration ceremonies in Springfield. And to submit questions, just go to the website askthe21st.org. Again, that's askthe21st, so askthe21st.org. Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. It takes a lot of paperwork to apply to college. You have to send in your family's information, your grades, recommendation letters, most of the time an essay. And until recently, most applications also had a checkbox that asked whether or not you've committed a crime. Advocates have said this question actually hurts people who are trying to turn their lives around. Late last year, the Common Application, which is used by 750 American colleges, decided to stop asking this question on their application forms. But there's still a lot of disagreement over this question of banning the box. Individual colleges can still choose whether or not to ask it. And here in Illinois, most higher ed institutions oppose legislation to remove this requirement. We're going to hear from both sides of this issue in a few minutes, but first, I'd like to welcome back Lee Gaines, who has been reporting on this for the Illinois Newsroom. They are a statewide collaboration of public radio stations. She's with us in our Urbana studios. Hey, Lee, welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
And Lee, you brought us our next guest, Chris Miner. He's also here in our studios. He graduated from the U of I. He's currently in a master's degree program at the U of I and spoke with Lee for her story. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being here as well.
Hello.
So I wanted to start with you and your story, because 4 years ago, your community college counselor said you should try to apply to the U of I. What was going on in your life around that time? When you were applying, did you think that you were going to see this question on an application?
I really wasn't sure. What it was with Parkland College, they didn't ask on their application, so it was something I wasn't really prepared for. I had dealt with employment and housing situations where I've been rejected, so I had seen the box, but not on a college application. Then the time came to fill out the application, and near the end, there it was, asking me about my past. At that time, I wasn't really sure how to react. I was really afraid. I was very scared, and I actually lied on that application. It had been, I had I'd been to prison. I think we probably assumed that and mentioned that. But I'd been out for 10 years, so I figured it was going to be safe. It wasn't going to come up. So a lot of the application I got in, there was no questions asked. So I wasn't sure, you know, when I first enrolled, if this was going to come back, if they had performed some kind of check or something, and I was going to be disclosed, and they were going to come after me and tell me I had to leave the school for lying. But it just, I was afraid. I'd become very pessimistic because of being incarcerated. I learned to expect the worst. That way, when it happens, it's not so bad. So I was kind of living very pessimistically, expecting something bad to happen.
And before you had been accepted at the U of I, did you talk much about your incarceration or the time that you had served in prison?
No, never. With social media and stuff, I had friends from those days who knew my past. But no, I didn't talk about it. I did not talk publicly about it. I did not disclose. It was very a stigmatized thing. I realized that, and having it used against me for apartment checks and employment checks, I knew it was something I really didn't want to self-disclose.
And so what went through your mind when you saw that question on the application the first time?
I was just afraid. Things were going so well in college at Parkland, and I thought this was all going to come to an end now, because if I couldn't get the U of I would assume other universities were going to do the exact same thing to me. So it was just fear that the time I'd put in and the belief that possibly I was going to get a legitimate second chance. Am I really going to get a second chance? Are they going to catch me here? And it was just very disheartening and very, very scary.
And then, so then you saw this question a second time because you graduated from the university with your bachelor's degree, and then you applied to a master's program. You're currently a master's student in social work.
Yes.
At the university. Mm-hmm. And what did you do the second time?
Well, the second time, I had already self-disclosed, so I definitely put that, yes, I had been convicted of a felony. There wasn't any follow-up questions, and that's odd, because that's where I think I have to kind of get a disclaimer that this is a very racialized situation. You know, I'm a middle-aged white man. I got through who may not have gotten through. There wasn't further questioning about it.
And would you want to tell people this is the crime that I was convicted of? Did you feel like you wanted to share that with people?
Almost did. It was the point where I have to tell you what's going on, and now I am scared that you're going to associate me with some super heinous crimes or people don't know. I mean, yes, I stole money. It was bad. And I was sentenced to a year in prison and a year of parole upon my release. And I completed all those sanctions, so it should be over. So, but regardless, I know the stigma continues. So I did kind of want to say, hey, disassociate me from certain things. But regardless, everybody deserves a second chance.
That's Chris Miner. He spoke with Lee Gaines for her story. We will tweet out a link to Lee's reporting. Lee, how common is Chris's story?
It's really hard to say because we don't have good data about this. I think Chris kind of hit the nail on the head in the fact that, you know, he didn't honestly disclose his criminal record. There has been at least one study done by a group called the Center for Community Alternatives out of New York. They were specifically looking at applications to the State University of New York system. And what they found was that of the roughly 3,000 people that checked, yes, I have a felony conviction on their application to SUNY, about 2/3 of them actually dropped out of the application process, in part because of having to provide supplemental information about their convictions.
And so to be clear, this doesn't mean that a college will automatically reject someone if they say, yes, I have been convicted of a felony.
Correct. Not at all. Actually, I was curious about that. So I did some data digging myself. And what I found was for the U of I system, we're talking Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield, about 320 people checked that box in 2015. About 229 checked that box in 2016 and 240 in 2017. And, you know, little less than half of those people were admitted. And then I asked specifically how many people were specifically denied admission because of their criminal record. And I think it was like 2 1 year, 2 the next, and about 11 people last year. So the number of people that are specifically denied because of their record is actually quite low. But it's a deterrent. That's really the issue here. It deters people from applying.
And Chris, you're nodding your head yes. You think this is a deterrent?
Yeah, definitely. Because a lot of people won't fill that out. Like she said, they don't want to mark it. They've come to expect the worst. They've seen this unemployment applications, housing applications. They're like, here we go again. I'm going to get rejected. I don't have this in me anymore to get rejected again.
And so just to be clear, this is not on the common application. This is still on the application for University of Illinois systems. As we've been talking about this issue with Lee Gaines and Chris Miner, I wanted to bring two more people into this conversation. Aaron Woodruff is chief of Illinois State University's police department, and he's on the line from ISU. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for joining our conversation.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for the invitation.
And Kadeen Bennett is also with us, the Director of Advocacy and Intergovernmental Affairs with the ACLU of Illinois. Hi, Kadeen. Thanks for being here as well.
Hi, thank you. And thanks for doing this show. It's really important.
And thanks for being here. Aaron, if I could start with you, as you've been listening to Chris's story and to Lee Gaines, your position at ISU, I imagine, is very clear because your job is to prevent crimes from happening and to keep students safe on campus. I imagine you believe that having this question is ultimately an important thing to maintain for college communities, correct?
Well, yeah, but I don't think it's quite as clear as many might perceive. I think all the college institutions all agree that there are certainly concerns, and we don't want to be a restriction on those with a past criminal history from gaining opportunities for education. I think my concern and the concern of all the other institutions and organizations I represent is that it's a one-size-fits-all approach. It's overly broad, and it doesn't provide universities an opportunity to assess risk for specific types of convictions. So Chris's conviction was a financial crime. Yes, that's not going to raise the same red flags as somebody who's convicted of murder or sexual assault is going to raise for an institution.
Mm. And so you would prefer, it sounds like, Aaron, that the question was maybe even more specific as opposed to have you committed a crime or have you been convicted of committing a crime?
Well, yeah, currently, you know, each institution has an opportunity to decide whether or not they want to use that type of question and how they implement a process to review it. So for ISU, we require them to disclose the convictions. It's not just an arrest. It has to be a conviction. And then we ask them for some information so that we can weigh it on a case-by-case basis. I think if you look at some of the proponents of who have been working on these types of legislations in other states, Louisiana, I believe, was the first state to pass it. And one of the important things that they put in theirs is that they provided for these exclusions for incidents of sexual assault, stalking, these significant safety concerns that all of us who work at institutions and, more importantly, the parents and students have. And I think that's the part that's getting ignored. And we've been trying to work with both the ACLU and Heartland Alliance to get those type of exclusions, and they refuse to put them in the legislation.
Kadeen, I wonder if you can share your thoughts on why you think it's important to support legislation that would eliminate this question entirely.
Yeah, I think the exclusions that the previous speaker referenced don't actually solve problems or make campuses more safe. So, you know, whether or not someone previously committed a murder or other kind of violent crime is not an indicator of what kind of student they'd be on campus. And I think some of our concerns are that, you know, our criminal justice system already has a disproportionate impact on Black and Brown folks. There are some folks who commit crimes, including sexual assault, who are never charged with that crime. They're never convicted, and they never have the opportunity for rehabilitation and the ability to integrate into society. So I think some of the frustration that we have about saying, well, if you put the box in and somebody who has had a sexual assault conviction in the past can check the box, our campus will be safer. That's not necessarily the case. We think there are concrete affirmative things that schools, universities, and colleges can do to reduce sexual assault on campus and address those issues. But having a checkbox in place is not that tool. And currently in Illinois, if somebody's been previously convicted of a sexual assault or they're on a sex offender registry list, once they're enrolled in the school, they have to register with on-campus security. So you already know who those people are. And we find that if you are somebody who has a previous criminal record, and no matter what the crime is, you're more likely, when you take that step to apply to college or university, you're more likely to want to better yourself, get a great education, get a job. Like, your path there can be more difficult than the average person. So once you're in there, you're more likely to work really hard in order to graduate and continue your life. And one of the earlier speakers said, you know, for many people, just seeing that question on an application is really deterrent. And finally, the fact that the common application put the question on and then took it off, I think that's a good indicator that shows that, you know, they're an application that, as the name says, it's very common for colleges and universities to accept it. The fact that they're saying that this doesn't need to be there in order to promote safety, I think is really important. And considering other schools that don't have the common apps, the question on their application. So the University of Texas system, the State University of New York, the University of California system, they're all schools that don't necessarily have a higher rate of crime or incidences because that question is on their application. Mm.
Erin, I wonder, to Kadeen's point, if you worry that this question turns away people, might deter students people who are trying to better their lives and have a college education but are worried about their past.
Well, it's interesting that the ACLU and these other organizations always cite evidence, and the Center for Community Alternatives study that was published in 2015 that continues to get quoted and heavily cited. It, first of all, it's not peer-reviewed or published, so it doesn't have any reliability or validity. So its conclusions are heavily biased, and I get that. What it does not prove, empirically prove, is that a relationship does not exist between campus crime and those who have a past criminal history. But some interesting research that came out from Iowa State just last month by Dr. DeLisi shows that even those who have been convicted of a violent crime or other serious felonies will likely commit the same crime again. In fact, for somebody who's prior convicted of a homicide, it increases the likelihood of them committing another homicide by 1,467%. And that is coming from a peer-reviewed study that has reliability and validity. So I question the fact that they can say that it's not going to show any difference. In fact, in 1975, there was a parolee released in the state of New York who enrolled at the State University of New York, Buffalo. The next year, he befriended a young lady, ended up raping and murdering her, then killing two others. The family school sued the school for admitting a potentially dangerous person. And then in 1981, the whole state of New York system actually required that criminal history question as a result of, quote, several violent crimes committed by ex-offenders on several campuses. So there is a history of these things.
Right.
When you don't,
and it sounds like, Erin, I imagine that this is, Chief Woodruff, this is something that you and Kadeen with the ACLU, it sounds like this is something both of you have a very fundamental disagreement about, this relationship. I'm not sure we're going to resolve it here, but Lee, can I ask you what college communities, certainly we've been hearing from ISU's police chief, Erin Woodruff, we just heard from him, but what are we hearing from other campus administrators, faculty, student at Illinois universities across the state?
Yeah. And really quickly, I do want to note, because I think this is important just to add as a fact to the conversation that they were having, is the U of I at Urbana-Champaign added the question in 1998, and a lot of other state schools added this question in the 2010s, as late as 2014. So the question hasn't always been here in Illinois. But what I will say, as far as students are concerned, I talked with a group called the Yes Apply Campaign. They started at University of Illinois Chicago. There's a chapter here at UIUC, and basically they are with the ACLU on this. They are lobbying very hard to remove this question entirely. And when I brought up the concern about sexual assault to them, their response was essentially like, look, a lot of the people that commit sexual assaults on this campus do not have a criminal record. A lot of them are students that have never been in trouble with the law. We think that our university should be doing a better job at educating people about consent and things like that, rather than deterring people from applying with this question. That was their response to this.
So we're almost out of time, but Chris, I wondered if I could just let you have the last word, as this is someone who affected you personally, as you've been listening to both Kadeen and Chief Woodruff, and to people who are listening all over the state. What do you want them to know about your experience or how they should be thinking about this?
Just that my experience and me getting through this is very different because of my privilege. I'm a white man, and a lot of people of color aren't going to have the same situation to navigate themselves through this. Regardless of who you are, if you've been convicted of a crime, crime, that means you've paid the price. You've paid society back, supposedly. So you've been released. You should have all rights restored, and you shouldn't be discriminated against for trying to find opportunities. These opportunities, education, lead to opportunities in jobs, et cetera, and this should reduce recidivism. So this should be a step that way.
That's Chris Miner, who is a current master's student at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Chief Woodruff for being with us as well, with ISU's Police Department, Kadeen Bennett, Director of Advocacy and Intergovernment Affairs for the ACLU of Illinois, and of course Lee Gaines, who brought all these folks to us. And we'll tweet out Lee's reporting if you'd like to see more of it. All of you, though, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about New Year's resolutions this week. Yesterday, we spoke about ways to stay in shape and eat better. Today, we're going to talk about how to tell the truth. Well, except for those little white lies. Those are pretty harmless, right? Well, Emma Levine isn't so sure. She's an assistant professor of behavioral science at University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and her new research explores the consequences of honesty in everyday life. And it turns out people can afford to be more honest than we think. Professor Emma Levine is with us now from the University of Chicago campus. Hi, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you've done lots of research about lying and honesty, and you've come to the conclusion that we are not necessarily thinking about lying in the best way. Why is that?
Well, typically when we think about lying and honesty, we're thinking about the lies that we tell to get ahead and undermine others, right? The selfish lies we tell to make ourselves look good and to make others look bad. And it's really clear, if you just ask people, it's really clear that these lies are wrong and have a variety of bad consequences for social relationships. So if we only focus on those, it's not clear how much we're advancing the conversation. And that's important because a lot of the lies that we tell are not these malicious, selfish lies. They're these lies that we're trying to tell to protect and care for other people. And it turns out that our understanding of those lies is really underdeveloped, and it's actually quite nuanced. And so a lot of my research tries to figure out kind of the consequences and basically how we think about these types of lies.
So you said that oftentimes we lie because we're trying to protect other people. I was actually thinking the opposite, that we lie just because it's easier for ourselves. I mean, just it's sort of a lie of either convenience or to avoid confrontation. I feel like that's like the most common what we call a white lie, right?
I think it's both. And I think what makes it complicated is people get these two motives, these two motivations confused. Right? When you tell someone they look great when they don't, I think part of it is a genuine fear of hurting their feelings. And part of it is a genuine discomfort causing potential, right, social distress or awkwardness. And so I think it's often both, which makes it a more complicated dilemma for communicators.
And so here's another little white lie that I think happened. I'm thinking about the holidays just happening. My birthday is in December. And when I've got a gift, even if it's one that I don't like, if someone says, do you like it? I automatically just said yes, because I felt like it would be rude to say no. And that's even if it wasn't true.
Right. And that's why that's a great example that I think highlights the nuance. It's not clear to me, and I certainly have lots of study participants, it's not clear to them that you should be telling the truth and that there's anything wrong with that lie. Especially, for example, if the gift can't be returned, right? What good is telling the truth? There's nothing you can do to change the situation. It would hurt the person's feelings. And so there, right, it might be truly well-intended and have some beneficial social consequences for you to accept the gift graciously. And avoid doing harm.
My guest is Emma Levine. She's an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and she studies honesty. And I wonder, Emma, if you can tell us a little bit more about one of your studies that focuses on honesty in everyday life. How do you measure this?
Sure. So one of the studies I've done recently that I'm super excited about is we had people actually go out in their everyday lives and be completely honest for 3 days. So people came to the lab. They knew they were going to do this 3-day communication experiment, but they didn't know what it would involve. And some of them were randomly assigned to be completely honest. So they got strict instructions that you should go out in your life and be honest with everyone around you. And other people were assigned to be kind in all of their communication. And then some people were just given instructions to just go about communicating with others as they normally would. And we have those people in all conditions, and I'm particularly interested in the honesty condition. We have them track their experiences every day and fill out a number of self-reports. So how did this experience make you feel? How did it affect your what we call hedonic well-being? So how pleasant and enjoyable was it? How much meaning did it give you? And how did it affect your social relationships? So people do that every day of the experiment. They also made a forecast before they started the study where they basically guessed. They provided a prediction of how much it would be enjoyable, provide meaning,
to
and
be
cause
honest.
Social connection. Right, exactly. And we find that, you know, through this experience, they mispredict what honesty will be like. It's far more enjoyable and benefits relationships more than they expect.
So people don't think that honesty is beneficial.
No, right? When
it's
you
so funny.
Imagine
the whole
our
control room is shaking their head saying, obviously, honesty is not beneficial. I just had to share that with you. All the producers are going, no.
Right. I mean, imagine showing up and imagine, or just after this conversation, imagine I tell you for the next 3 days, I want you to go and be honest, as honest as you can be with everyone around you, right? That gives you this visceral reaction that this is going to be really painful. And I know from my study that fear is misguided. If you were to actually do this, it's not as bad as you think.
And what are some examples of participants in your study who did this and found out it wasn't as bad as they thought?
I mean, it's so far reaching. So, for example, in our study, we had new declarations of love. So some of our participants were college students and, you know, they're holding in their feelings for their significant others and they speak up for the first time. And that, you know, you're so afraid of that. But, you know, sometimes that turns out to be a wonderful experience. On the flip side, we also had at least one person who broke up during the experiment. So you've held in a lot of criticism and resentment, and you speak that, and it ends up in breaking up a relationship. But even then, participants, or at least that participant, ended up thanking us, feeling like, right, if it all I had to do was speak my mind and that resulted in the end of a relationship, it probably should have ended, right? In either direction, the experience was more positive than they expected. Those are the more extreme examples, but other examples just include, you know, voicing workplace conflict or, right, speaking up about something that's been upsetting you or voicing criticism.
And so how did you measure that this honesty was actually positive for people?
Well, we had them fill out predictions before they completed the study and then every day of the study. And so what we're actually measuring is the degree of misprediction. So how much more beneficial is it than they expected? And we find, right, a significant difference such that it makes them happier and benefits their social relationships more than they expect. It's worth noting, though, right, we also had two other experimental conditions that I mentioned earlier. We had kindness and just your normal communication. People don't mispredict the experiences of being kind or just communicating as they normally would. So they're really just mispredicting honesty.
Were you surprised at the result of that?
Yeah, I mean, I was and I wasn't. Once you see the results, it makes perfect sense that, right, all these fears about honesty, or at least some of these fears, are misguided. I think what was surprising is that, you know, honesty in the end actually didn't look that different from kindness. So yes, we mispredict it. We think it will be worse and more uncomfortable than it is, but the kind of overall effect, how much happiness it brings us, is similar to how much being kind, how much happiness kindness brings us. And so that suggests to me that really, as long as we're kind of focused in our communication, we can have benefits. It just depends, you know, you could focus on either value.
I'm speaking with University of Chicago professor Emma Levine. Emma, I wonder, when we're thinking about this, I couldn't help but think about children. Oftentimes, and I think particularly parents might tell you, they feel like kids might inherently think that being dishonest is just easier, and that's just a natural condition of life.
So I'm not an expert in child psychology, but I am aware of some research on this topic, and I think actually children learn very early on that lying is wrong, right? They're biased towards truth, right? Very young children, they can't tell a lie. They are very, very literal because they're just understanding language. But then between ages about 4 to 7 is when they start to understand that, oh, right, mommy and daddy aren't telling the truth all the time. Sometimes they say they're not home when they are home. And, oh, there is this nuance here. They're telling me to tell grandma and grandpa that I like the gift. And actually, as they age, they develop a more complicated view of honesty, right? They start as really rule-bound and then realize, oh, there are exceptions here.
So you also studied honesty when it comes to healthcare. What were you trying to learn there?
So in that research, we were trying to understand across a couple of different contexts, but I think healthcare is particularly interesting, how communicators and targets, so that the targets of information, so patients in the case of healthcare, how they might have different views about honesty, these kind of comforting lies, but also omission, so the omission of information. And what we find there is both communicators and targets. So in healthcare, both doctors and patients recognize and believe that honesty is the most moral communication tactic. So there's no disagreement about that. But there is this interesting disagreement about kind of omission, so not saying anything or not providing prognostic information at all, compared to providing false hope. So doctors often justify omission. They might think it's acceptable to withhold information from a patient, and they think it's more acceptable to omit information than to give a patient false hope. But patients, at least the patients in our studies, actually believe the opposite, that they would rather have false hope than no information at all. Because you could, as you could imagine, as a patient, right, getting no information from your doctor is very anxiety provoking. And you wonder what's happening. You might imagine the worst case scenario. And so they actually prefer false hope over no information at all. But doctors who, right, are trained to think about honesty are trying to navigate this in a very complicated way and end up believing that omission might be acceptable.
Emma, what about on a bigger scale? Mm-hmm. So I wonder how this gets reflected in society and societal norms, especially as we're thinking about the way politicians or others are speaking and people are talking about speaking their truth. Do you think that that has changed the way we look at honesty or understand it?
I think it has, and I think it's added this extra layer of complication. So there's a lot of kind of popular rhetoric going on right now about kind of authenticity and radical honesty and being a straight shooter, right? We hear messages like that all the time. And I think that licenses people to say, you know, whatever they want, potentially really offensive and hurtful comments, and write it off as, oh, they were just being honest, or they were, you know, they were just speaking their mind, and they feel like something is moral about that, when in fact, they're just hurting other people. Right, which is not how most people judge what is good and bad. And I think it's extra complicated because sometimes, right, the same people who are just speaking the top of their mind and calling that honesty are also telling saying things that are falsifiable, that are untrue, but tend to be what they're thinking. And so I think it adds this complication of, right, how are we supposed to understand what is the truth if people are both saying that, oh, I'm a straight shooter, but also saying things that are untrue.
That's Professor Emma Levine. She is an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, sharing a little bit of her research. We will tweet out that most recent study that she was talking about. Emma, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about a new program at a Champaign area hospital that's looking at mindfulness for women who are pregnant. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. For Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or if you don't remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Thanks to Christine Herman for helping out today. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.